So I recently got to talk to Nathan Schneider about his new book, Everything for Everyone. Nathan has previously written on the Occupy movement. He's an excellent historian on cooperative economics. This book, Everything for Everyone, is about worker co-ops, both the sort of the history of them and some contemporary examples of the struggles that they go through and their importance in terms of creating a new economy. And you can find the book at his site, nathanschneider.info, and you can also just Google it, and some other sources will come up. So Nathan teaches at CU Boulder, which is about 2 hours south of us, and recently I got to talk to him about his book, and we had a great conversation.
Were there a couple of stories that were really compelling to you personally or emotionally?
Probably the first one that I begin the book with and that was personally the most powerful was discovering that my grandfather had been a director of a national hardware purchasing co-op. I had known he had, run a company later in his life. Kind of seems strange he'd run this big company and didn't get rich or anything, but did fine. But realized that realizing that this tradition had really shaped my family history. He also was born on a farm in Colorado that didn't have electricity until he grew up, really, because that's when the rural electric cooperatives started to form. And my family came to Colorado to farm beets, and they still bring their beets to the beet cooperative that was involved in bringing them here in the first place. I was just visiting a family farm this weekend, and saw all the Agfinity equipment there. Agfinity is an agricultural cooperative in our area. And so just realizing how my own family history had been shaped by this model was very moving to me. And to connect that to some of the much more kind of radical stories that I look at in the book, stories like the Catalan Integral Cooperative in Barcelona, where they're, playing with cryptocurrency and kind of trying to reinvent a financial system, or the the story of Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, trying to reclaim a black majority city for, economic development in the black community. These are things that I wouldn't necessarily expect to intersect with, my kind of conservative grandfather. But nevertheless, this is a tradition that cuts across so many of the lines that seem to divide us.
I think it's fashionable for us to say that there was never a golden age. Things have never, America's always been this shitty and everything. And I get the point of a lot of people pointing that out, because I do think that you can aggrandize the past and then sort of divorce yourself from the work that you need to do, that we all need to do to be better. At the same time, you're talking about a conservative family background. In that sense, a mainstream and kind of not seeing itself as radical. And it seems like there are these periods in American history where cooperative economies were not necessarily seen as radical. Nobody was throwing Molotov cocktails or anything. This was just a way that communities could work that seemed like it was very grounded in a conservative worldview.
Well, I think it's absolutely right that you don't want to have kind of rose-colored glasses about the past. But, the nice thing about the past is you have different mixes of stuff. For instance, that period of rural America, there was a rural progressivism that we don't see today, as well as a conservatism, mixed around there. And there were currents running in many different directions. And we can learn lessons from those experiences. And, one thing that has been really powerful for me is being able to draw on those lessons. So, for instance, today, a lot of my work is with a new generation of people coming into the cooperative movement, especially in the tech economy. So people who are messing around with online platforms and cryptocurrencies and digital labor networks. And you know, and a lot of the things they're doing are super hard, and they don't have a lot of infrastructure, and they can't work with the venture capitalists, and they can't work with a lot of the structures in the tech economy. I'm often kind of tempted to futility, but then I just think of, you know, the $128 billion agricultural bank sitting down the road from me in, you know, Southern Denver. Mm-hmm. And it's a reminder that when people organize and build policy and power around these kinds of ways of doing business, a kind of way of doing business where, you know, there's some democracy built into to the core of it, you can build that infrastructure. You can build the tools to make this stuff scalable and significant and have it really shape the world that we live in. And more I recognize how our world already has been shaped by the cooperative tradition in ways that we don't notice, you know, partly because it's just been around so long that, you know, we just don't even think of it as special, but also because of an ideology and a program of kind of indoctrination that has taught us that, you know, capitalism has brought about all the wonders of the, you know, of the industrial and post-industrial world, when in fact, it's not quite the case. There have been other currents at work too, and some of the best things around us, you know, are actually possible not through ruthless competition and investor control, but through various forms of shared ownership.
I assume that you've read John Curl's book, For All the People, which was my first. I mean, I had been following these movements for many years, but it was the first book I think I read that cataloged the myriad ways in which America can be seen as an experiment in cooperative economics, or at least those currents, as you say, are every bit as much a part of the American narrative. If we care about the American narrative, that's as much a part of it as any other story.
Yeah, and you know, Curl's book is you know, phenomenal in that way, and there's kind of a genre of these kind of cooperative litanies, you know, these long lists of all the different projects that people have been able to dig up. And, you know, sometimes I would be reading Curl and you know, and some other books like that. And, you know, sometimes it's just kind of exhausting, but sometimes mm-hmm. just so exhilarating to encounter all of these things and all of these examples, again, that have built our world. You know, I just read, for instance, a history of the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union. And it was kind of, it blew me away, you know, because this is a history of the area that I live in, told through the lens of farmer cooperative development. And, you know, it's telling stories about like the town I live in, the towns around me that just nobody around me knows, you know, that none of us talk about. You know, the first Grange was built here, you know, just right near where I live. The one of the towns where a lot of the people I work with live in, its mine was owned by, you know, the farmer cooperatives. You know, it's just all these ways in which shared ownership has kind of permeated our world that we don't see. And John Curl's book is important for that. Jessica Gordon-Nebhardt's Collective mm-hmm, Courage, mm-hmm. focusing on this tradition in Black communities, so important. Number of other works, but you know, with this book, I was really with Everything for Everyone, trying to, you know, not trying to be exhaustive in the way that those folks have been, but to focus on the stories, to focus on the characters, the people that I encountered in the process of getting to know this tradition, and really trying to emphasize the way in which this has been driven by personalities. And so much, I think sometimes there's an assumption that cooperatives are developed by a kind of faceless mass of people. Mm-hmm. You know, when in fact, I find that the stories of cooperative entrepreneurship, they're not, it's not necessarily a story of individualism, but it's a story of people, and people working together and working through some interesting dynamics, and people with really unusual vision, charisma, and talent building astonishing things. And I think that it's important for us to see that in order to recognize the possibility of our own agency in shaping a more cooperative economy.
Do you feel like these are people who, had they decided to turn their energies to venture capitalism and that kind of, you know, a different kind of entrepreneurialism, that they might have succeeded wildly in that realm?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a these are just astonishing stories. I mean, when you look at somebody like Murray Lincoln, who was, you know, one of the early, he was the second president of the National Cooperative Business Association. He was one of the progenitors of some of the big mutual insurance companies and the rural electric cooperatives that brought electricity to most of rural America within about a decade. You know, this was somebody who was going in and out of President Roosevelt's office all the time, who was, you know, a major power broker, you know, of the period, yet is completely forgotten. And then, you know, you look at somebody like Father Albert McKnight, who was one of the developers, who's a Catholic priest, African-American priest, one of the developers of the infrastructure around the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, enabling mm-hmm. black farmers in the South to have ownership over their land, which played an instrumental role in strengthening the civil rights movement. And, you know, this was a, you know, visionary fundraiser and financial ecosystem developer, also a phenomenal kind of visionary as a Pan-Africanist, you know, an anti-colonialist, you know, saw what he was doing in the American South as integrally connected with, you know, revolutionary movements in Africa. You know, these are people who have been forgotten far too quickly, I think, because, you know, they just don't fit into the narrative of what, you know, a business person is supposed to look like. They don't fit into, also, they didn't accumulate wealth to the degree that they could slap their name on every business school that they could find.
So they were not necessarily people of great privilege, although it sounds like they may have been, they may have had some social capital, they may have had some good educational benefits. So they, you know, they had some privileges, but they were not they were not trust fund kids all the time.
Well, I mean, you have people coming from all sorts of walks of life in this movement. And that, I think, is also really important to recognize, too. There's a lot of emphasis today among the new generation coming into the cooperative movement, that this is something for the most vulnerable people in society. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, throughout the history of cooperative movements in this country, these have served those who are really working at the margins. But when you look at the people who come together to make this ecosystem work, it's included all sorts. It's included people ranging from Fannie Lou Hamer in the South, you know, setting up cooperative farms alongside her, you know, organizing work, to people like Edward Filene, you know, who's a department store magnate who came across the cooperative bank system in Canada and was completely inspired and led the development of what he came to call credit unions in the United States, and made, you know, credit unions the system and movement that they have become, you know, probably more than anybody else. Now a third of Americans are members of a credit union. He helped pioneer the legislation that made that possible. You know, so I think it's, when you look at this history, you see actually a series of alliances among people with varying levels of privilege and access in the society. And, you know, I hope that that's a model of how we can, you know, build this economy going forward, rather than just waiting for, you know, this to emerge in the hardest possible circumstances.
I constantly wonder about this question, that there are a lot of folks in the cooperatives movement and in the general movement to reclaim the commons and the intentional communities movement and other places where people are building alternatives. There is not, it seems like it's a very mixed bag in terms of the sort of political orientations and consciousness that a lot of those folks have. And I'm not pretending to, you know, be looking at all that from some objective perch somewhere, but I keep thinking about the phenomenon or the tendency of capital, especially now, especially in the world, in this time where finance capital is so powerful, to crush alternatives. It feels to me like a lot of vociferous proponents of cooperativism don't have a political perspective baked into their worldview that accounts for the tremendous power, and it, you know, it's really, it's expressed kind of in, you know, even in Leon Russelson's song about the diggers and the world turned upside down, where the, you know, the diggers built their community, it was working really well, and then the propertied classes came in and literally burned all of it down. We see many other examples of that. We see geopolitical examples of that with Cuba and arguably Venezuela. When we make something nice, it immediately falls under attack. And the co-ops and communities movements don't always get that. And then you have, I think, you know, a lot of hardcore kind of communists out there, you know, socialists out there who don't get necessarily the cooperatives movement. And so there doesn't seem to be a real united political front ready to fight those kinds of battles. At the risk of sounding somewhat apocalyptic, it seems like we're going to be fighting those battles. People are going to be implementing these experiments and these alternatives to a greater degree in an accelerated way. And I think those battles are going to intensify. In your experience of examining kind of a cross-section of people who are involved in this, you know, what do you think it's going to look like in the next several years as people try harder and harder to break away from a capitalist model and find that, you know, that capitalism has this inertial and kind of cancerous way of trying to stop those things from happening?
Well, there's a really kind of eerie opportunity that has been you know, increasingly lodged in my mind as I've been working on this project, which is that this tradition cuts across, you know, our political lines in some really unexpected ways and presents an opportunity for power that is really quite significant. And I think it's absolutely right that you need to think about the kind of supporting power structures in order to make these things possible. If you look at the great moments of cooperative development in our country's history, you know, it was following the passage of the enabling legislation for credit unions. It was the Rural Electrification Act and, you know, in the 1930s that enabled electric cooperatives in rural areas to access essentially bank rate loans. And other such decisions like 1922, the Capper-Volstead Act, which protected farmer cooperatives from antitrust laws, you know, really critical interventions in policy that essentially just level the playing field, enable cooperatives to function in a world that's, you know, largely designed by investors. So today, you know, in 2016, both the Democratic and Republican platforms advocated increased worker ownership of the businesses where people work. That's kind of astonishing for a moment where we're told all the time that nobody agrees about anything. Politicians, mainstream politicians on both sides agree about that. They have different reasons. The rationales are different. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republican version talks about, you know, personal responsibility and expanding capital ownership. The Democratic side talks about worker power and equity and these sorts of things, but they're talking about the same policy. And same for, you know, there was just a bipartisan bill passed, you know, I think a very problematic one that liberalizes some financial regulation, but a lot of the impetus for passing it was to support credit unions and community banks. Again, bipartisan support. In August, we saw the passage of the Main Street Employee Ownership Act, which was the first major, you know, employee ownership legislation passed since the 80s, I believe. Mm-hmm. And again, it was led by Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democratic senator, but bipartisan support all the way. You know, we see a lot of the people on the left, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, really picking up employee ownership as an issue that they seem to be campaigning on. But actually, you know, Paul Ryan has been advocating the same thing. You know, we have this opportunity, I think, to build a real power base for these kinds of models in some surprising ways. And I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you know, whatever the or something, you know, off of that map, as you know, many of us might consider ourselves to be, you know, we're feeling a lot of the same pain, you know, and when you get down to it, you know, capitalism is hurting everybody. And this is a strategy that's kind of obvious. The thing that terrifies me is that, you know, one side or the other is going to like claim that rhetorical space and own it and dominate it. And then everybody else is going to think, oh, only they do that, mm-hmm. which has happened at some periods in the past. And it's forced co-ops to go underground when they've, you know, presented themselves as that, you know, when in fact, this is like a very, you know, kind of broad based political tradition in our country. And, you know, it's an opportunity to cut across the like incredibly polarizing forces that want polarization, you know, that want us to think that we have nothing in common, when in fact, actually, you know, we do. We're all inheritors of that 19th century populism that built rural America through cooperative enterprise. You know, that's something that we can all share and celebrate. Well, you know, one thing that really I came away with from this project was a feeling of a generation gap, a feeling that there is this old legacy and there's a new generation and they're not talking to each other and they don't know how to work together. So a couple things I got really motivated to get involved with is I'm putting together a conference on November 7th here in Colorado at CU Boulder called the Colorado Shared Ownership Summit. And it's really designed just in our state to bring together those generations and say, hey, look at the cool things, you know, look at the amazing things this older generation has accomplished. Look at the amazing ideas that this younger generation wants to try. Can we help each other? And so it's hard work because of the cultural, you know, the languages are different, the ways of thinking and the priorities are different. But I'm hoping we'll be able to make a step in that direction. And, you know, another project with a lot of the same motivation is I'm helping to get started this first equity accelerator for cooperative startups called Start.coop. And we're about to, you know, start with our first class. And again, we're hoping to have a model where older co-ops can invest in and support and mentor new ones. And so it's a new model we're trying out, but really, really hopeful about it. And I hope that if we can, you know, cross some of these lines, bring together that legacy that we have to build on with some of these, this new energy, you know, we can make this tradition more visible again and present it as a real option for, you know, transforming the future of our economy.
You talked about some really good enabling legislation that's coming out. What hasn't happened yet that you think should happen in terms of legal and policy change that would enable the model that we would all like to see happen?
You know, I think a really major thing is just learning from what rural cooperators built in the early 20th, late 19th century. So, you know, one piece of it is the Kapper-Volstead Act, which protects farmers from some antitrust law. You know, we're in a moment where interest in antitrust is coming back, rightly so, and there should be much stronger antitrust enforcement. But we should look to cooperatives as an alternative way of building scale that supports small business rather than crushes it. So integrating cooperative thinking into how we think about antitrust. Another piece of that tradition is financing. So the Farm Credit System and the Rural Electrification Act were both ways that the government kind of backed the development of a cooperative finance ecosystem, just as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are government-backed supports for the housing market. And if we had access to, you know, appropriately cost, you know, structured financing for cooperatives beyond the agriculture sector, it would be much, much easier for cooperatives to compete in a market full of this kind of investor glut, where it's so right now so much easier to sell a great idea to an investor than to build it in a community. And so those kinds of things, again, just learning from what people have done in the past and have kind of confined to agriculture and expanding it so that we can build cooperative banks for tech and for for the future of work and for big data and for, you know, globalized supply chains, you know, then, you know, I think we'll be in a position to make a real difference. But, you know, the inspiration, you know, comes straight from what has already been done, you know, from the courageous and powerful efforts of, you know, the cooperators that have gone before.
We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.